A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations and institutions. Today, we'll keep our spotlight on accomplished musicians who are passing their musical thoughts and inspiration on to future generations. I'll speak with harpist Anne Hobson Pilot, who became the first African-American woman to be named principal at a major U.S. orchestra, and also Frank Wong, concertmaster of the New York Philharmonic. Both are being honored this year by their alma mater, the Cleveland Institute of Music, and we'll hear about their journeys in the musical world and what they hope to impart to younger musicians. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. For the first time in more than three decades, the Curtis Institute of Music will have new leadership at the head of its vocal department. Bass baritone Eric Owens and Danielle Orlando, who is currently principal opera coach at Curtis, will lead the Institute's Vocal Studies Department and Curtis Opera Theater, beginning with the 2019-2020 season. They will succeed Michael Eliason, who became head of the department in 1988. In a statement, Curtis said Orlando and Owens, himself a Curtis graduate, will begin to hear auditions next year and share responsibilities for artistic and educational planning for the following school year. Hollywood is joining in the tribute to the centenary of Leonard Bernstein's birth. Entertainment news source Deadline.com reported that Bradley Cooper will star as the iconic conductor and composer and direct the film himself, the second Bernstein biopic on the drawing board. According to Deadline, Cooper will write the script with Josh Singer, and the project will be financed jointly by Paramount Pictures and Amblin. Earlier this month, Deadline reported that Jake Gyllenhaal will produce and portray the lead in a film called The American that is slated to begin filming this fall. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. When Anne Hobson Pilot was named Master Harpist in 1966 by the Washington National Symphony, she became the first African-American woman named to a principal position in a major U.S. orchestra. That barrier broken, it was by no means the only one she would face in her career, as not even that position would shield her from the realities of racial policies as she toured with the orchestra. Her talent and determination led her in 1969 to Boston, where she served as principal harpist with the Boston Pops and assistant principal of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and then in 1980 as principal harpist of the BSO. Throughout her orchestral and solo career, she has also given back, teaching and training students at the New England Conservatory of Music, Boston University, and Tanglewood Music Center, among other places. Later this month, the Philadelphia-born musician will be recognized with an honorary doctorate from her alma mater, the Cleveland Institute of Music, where she will recount some of her experiences in her commencement address to its graduates. I had the chance to speak with her about some of the challenges she faced and her message to the students.
Part of my background has been peppered with adversity, being the first African-American principal harpist and being coming along back in the 60s was a very troubling time, of course. And so my message, I hope, is to inspire the students there to recognize that they can be successful in spite of adversity.
With the challenges that you did face back then and the adversity, how did that challenge you to keep moving forward? What were some of the ways that you were able to push past that and keep doing what you wanted to do?
Well, I think it made me stronger. And that, of course, is the message that I would like to give to them, is to use adversity to make you stronger and that if you have a goal in mind, that you just have to keep pursuing that goal no matter what, no matter who tries to stop you or who tries to get in your way. To me, it was music, and the harp was something I loved and something I loved doing and was good at. So it was very easy for me to just keep going and to ignore the people that tried to take me down in the process.
Well, when you first started on the harp, some of your initial work was in the non-classical field. You worked with Johnny Mathis and some other singers and performers. What in particular was it that moved you to look more closely at the classical world and head in that direction?
Well, I actually had a more classical background. My mother was a concert pianist, so I was hearing classical music basically from the time I was born. So that's where I was planning on going. But when I was a student before the Cleveland Institute of Music, I was a student at the Philadelphia Musical Academy. And the Latin Casino was a place where these acts came, the Johnny Mathis and Peggy Lee. And so as a student there, I was offered a job to play with the band there. And it was a very lucrative job. So, of course, I accepted it. And I actually enjoyed doing it. But after I transferred out to the Cleveland Institute of Music, then I kind of went back more into the classical route.
And as you worked your way then through to ultimately the Boston Symphony Orchestra, give us a sense of the context and the environment. What were some of the challenges you had to deal with, and how did you face them?
Well, there were times when I was not allowed to play certain places because of the color of my skin. And, you know, it was hurtful, but it wasn't anything to quit over. It was something that I just kept going. My first job actually was with the Washington National Symphony in D.C., and we used to tour down south a lot. And there were times when I was not allowed to eat in certain places where there were signs that said white only and that kind of thing. And again, I had friends that would find a place where I would be able to go to eat. But then, for example, where the National Symphony performed their concerts at that time was at Constitution Hall in D.C., which was the hall that Marian Anderson was not allowed to sing in back during her days when she wanted to put on a concert, and the DAR at the time would not allow her to sing there. So when I joined the National Symphony in 1966, I was told by many that this was a real change because I was allowed to play there. So I guess I consider some progress. And I recognize that there were others before me who had even greater challenges than I did. So that was encouraging.
A lot of people are looking at the orchestral world and wondering how much progress we have made. Orchestras certainly are examining and re-examining the ways that they pick programming and find musicians, and really trying to find more ways to encourage diversity. In all your experience, what would you say are some of the ways that orchestras should address this issue and find ways to improve the way they approach that?
Well, it's a difficult problem. I mean, when I joined Boston Symphony in 1969, I auditioned behind a screen. And those were the early days of the screens, because before that they had no screens, and a lot of the conductors that had jobs would just offer a position to their friends or friend of a friend, that kind of thing. But back in, I think it might have been just a year or so before I auditioned for Boston behind a screen, they started that process to try to make it more fair. And what ended up happening is that an orchestra that might have been 100% men, a lot of women started getting jobs because of the screen. So there had been some kind of prejudice against women back then, because the men were the ones that were picking the people. So when they when they put up the screen, then a lot of women who played really well were able to get jobs. But it has been a problem as far as people of color are concerned, and there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, even with the screen, you need to have a very good instrument to compete against others that do. And so that's a problem. You need to have good training. You need to have good instruments. And all of that is improving now. I mean, they have organizations like Project Step in Boston and Sphinx in Detroit that are offering instruments and lessons to string players. So I think that gradually, and it is incredibly too gradual in my opinion, I think all of that will change. But I mean, for example, when I joined the BSO, when I joined the National Symphony in 66, I was the only black member then. When I joined the Boston Symphony in 69, I was the only black member. And maybe 20 or more years later, 1991, the cellist Owen Young was hired. So there was two of us. When I retired in 2009, since then, Owen Young has been the only black player. And I think that's not only true of Boston, it's true of many of the major orchestras around the country. So it still is a problem, but I am positive that it's going to get better over the years.
Well, over the years, you've also devoted a good amount of time to teaching, including at the New England Conservatory. What did you enjoy most about that?
Well, the level of students that went to NEC, and I also taught at BU, Boston University, for a number of years, not as many as the conservatory, but the level of students was very, very high. So it was a real pleasure to work with students that wanted it, that were willing to work hard. And so it was exciting for me to see the progress of these kids. And some of them have done quite well over the years.
Well, there's been a lot of changes in both music schools and the way that young people can create their careers now. So many either entrepreneurial or different ways to do music. What are your thoughts on where music performance and where music careers can go nowadays for young aspiring musicians?
Well, it's good that there are so many ways that they can get jobs, and because there, especially for harp, that's one of the things that always bothered me. I would have a student at NEC or BU for 4 years, sometimes 6 years, and then at the end of that time, they turn to me and say, "Well, what do I do now?" And of course, they apply for jobs, they audition for jobs, but when you have as a harpist, when most orchestras only employ one person, it's very, very hard to get a job as a harpist. So fortunately, there are other things that they can do. You know, and as you said, there are a lot of entrepreneurial opportunities out there for playing chamber music, for playing weddings, receptions, that kind of thing, to apply for teaching jobs. So there's quite a bit now that a lot of harp students and other students are doing to earn a living.
And what was it specifically about the harp that spoke to you, and has that changed over the years the more you've played?
Well, I had a piano background. I started piano when I was 6 years old. And as I said, my mother was a pianist, and I could always hear her playing, obviously, a whole lot better than I ever could. So it was discouraging, and I didn't practice all that much. So when I went to high school, Girls High in Philly, they had a very extensive music program there. So I decided to take another instrument, and the music teacher at the school recommended the harp. I didn't really know much about the harp, but she recommended it. And what I really liked about the harp was you're able to make music with your fingers in direct contact with the strings, unlike the piano where you hit the key, and you really have to be much more creative to make a phrase and that kind of thing. You don't have a bow to help you. You can't blow through a reed to help you. So I like that about the harp, and I still do many years later.
That was harpist Ann Hobson-Pilot, who will receive an honorary doctorate from her alma mater, the Cleveland Institute of Music, and deliver the commencement address to graduating students on May 19th. You can find her website at annhobsonpilot.com. Also being recognized this year by the school is New York Philharmonic Concertmaster Frank Wong, who is receiving its Distinguished Alumni Award and was asked to prepare some remarks for its honors convocation. Wong became concertmaster at the Philharmonic in September of 2015 after serving as concertmaster of the Houston Symphony Orchestra. His first love, though, was chamber music, and he has been able to continue his chamber playing as a member of the New York Philharmonic String Quartet. I caught up with him recently while he was watching his daughter and chatted with him about his career choices and the importance of his time at the Cleveland Institute of Music.
CIM was kind of the main bulk of my studies. I was there for 7 years, and you know, I do feel that it was because of those years, the environment there, and my teacher, my chamber music coaches, it was such a good environment for me personally to experience what music is all about. You know, when I went there, I don't think I was totally sure I was going to be a musician. And by the time I left, or even after my first 2 years or so, I just was completely in love with music, and I knew there was nothing else I wanted to do. So, you know, my teachers and colleagues had a lot to do with that, but the school was such a inspiring place as well. So I'm very happy to be able to, you know, reconnect with the school in a way. And it is a huge honor. I never expected anything like that.
Well, as part of that, you'll be addressing the students as part of the honors convocation. What do you hope to impart to the students in your address?
You know, I unfortunately can't be there in person. We have a concert that day here in New York, but I did do a taped interview. You know, I didn't get into too many specific things, but, you know, these days I think it is a challenge to talk about how music is relevant and how it can impact people's lives. It is such a beautiful art form, and there are so many great things about it. And I think it's hard to, in today's age with so many distractions and such short attention spans, especially in kids. I know very well from my daughter that, you know, there's just so many things that can occupy people's minds. And I think going to a concert, and if you understand the language, like if you're not listening to something for the first time ever, you know, if you've been exposed to it somehow, or if you know how to listen to music, it can be such a rewarding experience. But, you know, there are a lot of, it's such a complicated topic. I think I just touched upon it a little bit. But obviously, you know, it's a important discussion that I think many arts organizations are talking about these days.
What have you been seeing in recent years then of some of the ways that organizations are working to address this and, you know, perhaps reach out in new and creative ways?
Every organization has their plans, and their you know, a lot of attention goes into how to bring younger audiences in, for example, or how to educate kids about music. And for me, I think seeing how, again, this is a personal experience, but seeing how my daughter responds to music just by being around it at a young age, you know, I find it hard to imagine that a kid would not fall in love with music if they grow up with it in the house, or just if they're listening to it constantly. I mean, my daughter is not even two, and she's always asking to listen to Peter and the Wolf, for example, or, you know, anything that if she can say the name of a piece, she'll just keep asking to hear it because it's so colorful, especially to a kid. And you know, when I was in the Houston Symphony and also in the New York Philharmonic, we have these amazing outreach programs for schools, and we bring kids into the hall to perform young people's concerts for them. And that's all, you know, a part of the education and development. But I think ultimately, you know, it has to be something that people prioritize in the house, in the home as well. And I think that is the challenge. A lot of people are not aware of how great music can be and how powerful it can be. If you've never been exposed to it, you know, it's very difficult to experience it.
Well, what was your first interaction with music and what drew you to that, and particularly to the violin?
Well, so when I was younger, I started playing the violin because my mom is a violinist, right? So it wasn't necessarily my choice. And I am a classic example of someone that, even though I learned an instrument, I did not like it. I didn't like having to practice every day. I didn't like the, you know, the work aspect of it, I guess. But then when I was a little older, when I was in Cleveland, after I was old enough to kind of experience more a wider range of emotions, and I could begin to sense that the music I was playing really reflected a lot of these emotions that I was starting to experience. Like, you know, love is a classic example. Like, once you kind of experience what love is and you can kind of hear it in the music that you play, it becomes very meaningful and it becomes very special. So, you know, I think for me, it was once I made that relationship that music could be used to express a wide range of emotions in a way that didn't have to be specific. Like, you didn't have to tell people exactly what you were going through or what you were feeling, but the music could give people an idea of the emotion behind it. Because everybody has felt the same, you know, range of emotions in their life, no matter what the situation is. So in that way, it's such a universal language. And that's the point for me where I realized, hey, this is something amazing, and I don't want to do anything else.
Well, another major transition for you came professionally when you started to move from, or you decided to move from chamber music to orchestral, and in particular, seeking out concertmaster positions. Describe a bit what went into that.
I get asked this a lot, the difference between chamber music or playing solos like concertos or playing in an orchestra. And for me, chamber music is the root of all music making. For example, in my experience, if you're a great chamber musician, you could probably be a great orchestral player or a great soloist. Whereas if you're a great soloist, but you've never played any chamber music, you will run into difficulties in certain situations. That's one reason my time at CIM was also so special, because my teacher was a quartet player, Don Weilerstein, and my chamber music coaches were all so inspiring to me. So for me, chamber music is really what I try to bring with me to the orchestra. And I always try to get a sense of making the strings feel like a giant quartet, for example. Chamber music just means that you're listening and watching and reacting. And if a large ensemble can do that, it's fantastic. It's an incredible experience.
And once you started setting your sights on a concertmaster position, were you looking specifically toward the New York Philharmonic, or did you have a number of places in mind?
I was not. Going into the orchestra world was a little bit of not an accident, but kind of a very strange sequence of events. I was in a string quartet called the Ying Quartet. We were in residency at the Easton School of Music, and I was very happy there. Quartet life was my dream when I was in school. So I really was very happy. I had some very good students that I worked with at the Easton School of Music. But, you know, Houston was my hometown, so my parents lived there. And when they offered me the concertmaster job, I turned it down the first time because I was so happy in this quartet. But, you know, my parents being there and kind of me, you know, I was reaching a point in my life where I wanted to reconnect with them in a way. My parents left me in Beijing when I was born, and I grew up with my grandparents. So I wasn't very close to them. Older, I really wanted to you know, have a chance to really spend time with them. So that my personal kind of goals were a big part of my reason to leave the quartet and go to Houston. New York was a completely different story. They had two or three concertmaster auditions. I was, again, so happy in Houston. I met my wife there. We had a great life. And New York was kind of a surprise. I went up to play an audition for them, not really expecting anything. Things just worked out the way that they did. And, you know, now we're very happy. We got married, moved here, and had our first child all within about a year and a half. So it's been kind of a whirlwind.
Kind of coming full circle then, some of your duties do involve teaching. You're both at Juilliard as well as the Shanghai Academy that the New York Philharmonic
right.
has. What do you
right.
enjoy bringing to that aspect?
Well, teaching is such a joy for me. I absolutely love hearing kids that are serious about music, that want to pursue it as a profession. And even if they don't, you know, I think it's very nice to just work with kids and try to inspire them to understand music the way that my teachers have inspired me. It's not a question in my mind that without the teachers that I had, I'm sure I would have quit music and, you know, pursued a different career somewhere. So a good teacher that doesn't just, you know, talk about technique and how to play things fast and clean, but someone that can inspire a student to fall in love with music and to really use it as a language to communicate these universal emotions and ideas. That is a true joy, I think. And it's something I would love to do more and more as I hopefully will have more and more time in the future. These days, it's a little tricky to balance everything.
That was Frank Wong, concertmaster of the New York Philharmonic and this year's Distinguished Alumni Award recipient from the Cleveland Institute of Music. You can read more about Wong at nyphil.org/about-us/artists. And more information about the Cleveland Institute of Music is available at cim.edu. If you have any inspirational thoughts of your own for the next generation of musicians, share them on our Facebook page at WWFM The Classical Network, or on Twitter at WWFMClassical, #AtTempo. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on AtTempo, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to WWFM.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to AtTempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. AtTempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.